Good afternoon, good morning, Cosby staff, Norwalk. We're going to have an education session on leases.
Good afternoon. This is the first time we'll talk to you this week on leases, but we will be coming back on Thursday for the joint decision-making session. So as ever, just a reminder that this is our education session, which is a forum for questions on the paper as opposed to deliberating or expressing views. We only have 45 minutes in this session, and the idea is we are going to hope to go through all three papers for discussion this week to allow you the opportunity to ask questions on those papers. So given the short time we have, at whatever point the discussions are getting into debating or expressing views, then I'm likely to move us on to ensure that we have enough time for questions on all three papers. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Sarah to take us through the first paper.
So we'll first be discussing Agenda Paper 3A, which discusses the definition of a lease. This paper does not propose any fundamental changes to the definition of a lease guidance proposed in the 2013 exposure draft. Rather, it proposes confirming the general definition of a lease and the underlying principles proposed in the 2013 ED. Agenda Paper 3A does, however, propose a number of clarifications to the guidance in the 2013 ED to address feedback received on the proposals. These clarifications include clarifying when a substitution right is substantive, describing the economic benefits from the use of an asset as the potential cash flows from the use of an asset, making various clarifications regarding the assessment of who controls the use of an asset when the customer and supplier both have decision-making rights that will affect the cash flows derived from the use of an asset, clarifying that restrictions around the use of an asset will generally not prevent a customer having the ability to control the use of the asset, and removing the guidance regarding assets incidental to the provision of services that was proposed in the 2013 ED. So with that, I will hand it over to the board members if they have any questions on Agenda Paper 3A.
Sure.
Yeah. Question on restrictions on right of use. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's protective rights. Were you thinking in that vein, or are you thinking broader than that? I mean,
generally, protective rights. That's where the discussion in the paper is. There were just some questions that we received regarding, you know, if there's restrictions around when a retail unit could open, or, you know, if you can only drive a car or a truck for a certain number of miles. Would that in itself mean that you don't have the ability to control the use of an asset? And we would think that generally those types of protective rights are more designed to protect the supplier's interest in the residual asset and are more designed to kind of limit the scope of what you would be able to control without actually taking away your ability to control the use of an asset.
Yeah, just thinking any contract, lease or anyone, usually, you know, the one party has got all sorts of clauses in there protecting their interests or rights or at law and stuff, and I would think, you know, stuff in normal trade usage and stuff that protects the person with receivable should be fine. So you weren't thinking all that much beyond that.
Yeah. Right. On the same issue, let's assume that instead of limiting the use of the asset to, say, 50,000 miles a year, if it is a contract for, say, only 5,000 miles a year on the same truck, with the supplier being able to use the excess, i.e. 40,000 for other customers, would that restriction transform the contract into an access to a capacity instead of controlling the asset?
Yeah, exactly. And we do say in the paper that generally we don't think that protective rights should mean that you don't control the use of an asset. But in your example, when those rights or the restrictions around the use of an asset essentially mean that the customer doesn't have the rights to the economic benefits, to all of the economic benefits in the asset, then you're right, that would transform. And there will be cases where those restrictions will mean that it essentially turns into a service.
But that's where commercial reality sets in. And you need two parties to a contract to agree to the terms.
Stephen?
Sarah, the bit about the supplier not benefiting from substituting an alternative asset, how easy will it be to identify whether that's true or not. And did you consider alternatives? I'm particularly thinking of significant economic incentive, whether that notion might be better applied here.
Well, that was part of our thinking around making this clarification, that you should be considering whether the supplier would benefit from using from exercising the substitution rate. Because one of the kind of pieces of feedback that we received was the 2013 ED had focused on just the cost involved in substitution, and when the costs would be so great that they would create an economic disincentive or an economic barrier, then that would mean that your substitution rate wasn't substantive. And there was a lot of feedback, you know, just around, well, at what level does that economic barrier happen? At what level should the cost be assessed? And so we thought that the clarification around benefit would be a way of addressing that. And I do think that in most cases it will be clear if the supplier would really be able to benefit from exercising that substitution rate. To take the example that was kind of in the 2013 AD, when you have a fleet of rail cars, you will be keeping them at your premises, you will be allowed to use them, the supplier will be allowed to use them whenever the customer isn't using them. I think in cases like that, it is going to be clear that the supplier really would benefit, because it's not going to cost him very much, and he'll be getting real kind of economic cash flows from substituting the asset and using it for himself.
I was thinking about the substitution of one photocopier for another. Mm-hmm. How would you identify whether the supplier is benefiting from that action?
Well, I think you would just have to kind of assess both the cost involved in substituting. So, you know, if it is going to cost him a lot to take a new photocopier in and switch that out, and then what other alternative uses it would have for that photocopier that it would be substituting.
I can just imagine some auditor saying, so prove to me they've got a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would think, and that's kind of another clarification that we've made too, that if it's really, especially from the customer's perspective, since this is all from whether the supplier can benefit, if it is difficult for the customer to make that assessment, then it can just assume that the right is not substantive and move on to the rest of the definition of a lease assessment.
Are you thinking the hurdle is set too high?
I mean, one thing for us, and I suppose thinking about, by the way, the overall definition, or maybe for me, is that naturally the way the guidance focuses and flows, and I think it makes sense for ease of application, is that we kind of have two pieces. We say, you know, there needs to be an identified asset, and then the customer needs to have the right to control the use of that identified asset. But actually, I think that that's just separated into two pieces for almost ease of application. So that if, for instance, you come along to step one and you say there's no identified asset, then there's no need to even, you know, continue through and do a more assessment around control. However, for me, I think that looking at whether there's an identified asset and looking at substitution rights is a natural part of looking at control and whether you've got the ability to direct the use. So if, you know, what we're kind of saying is if a supplier has a substantive substitution right, then in practice you're saying it's really the supplier, therefore, that can make the decisions about use if he can come along at any time and sort of exchange it. I suppose the long and short of what I'm saying is that I think what's important is even if you conclude any substitution right is not substantive, it doesn't necessarily therefore mean it's a lease. It's just saying you've crossed step one, that it's an identified asset, but you still look at the control piece to see who you think is making the actual decisions about use. And I suppose for us as well, and trying to add clarification around substitution rights, we did have a look at some of the IFRS 10 wording at looking at when, you know, rights that give you control when they're substantive or not, and it does use similar type of wording that talks about if the rights provide benefit or not.
Pat?
Two observations. First is along the lines of Stephen's question or observation, and that is, I think it would be helpful in trying to support this assessment that the lessee would have to make, that you suggest indicators like whether or not the lessor is the custodian of the asset. So in your example, the rail car, it's very easy when you're the custodian of the asset to do that swap, whereas if the copier's in Steve's office having to go in and pull it out, those are kind of indicators, I think. The other issue in my mind that came to me when I was thinking about this was, are you doing kind of a net present value calculation? And I don't think we're going that far. So I just think it's important to kind of characterize the kind of analysis the lessee is actually going to do with a little bit more specificity. So that's just an observation. The other question or observation I have is in example 4A, and I just want to clarify the meaning of terms. Broadly speaking, I support your recommendation here. I have no problem with it. You say in the analysis piece, you say the contract contains a lease. The customer has the ability to direct the use of the rig by making decisions that most significantly affect the economic benefits to be derived. Okay. Then further down, a couple sentences later, we say the customer's decision-making rights about the location of the rig results in customer's decision-making having the most significant effect on the cash flows to be derived from use. So my question is it an assessment of broad economic benefits and rights, or is it just an assessment of cash flows?
Yeah. And that gets into another kind of clarification that we would propose making, which is the 2013 ED had just talked in terms of general economic benefits. And we are proposing to clarify, kind of consistent with the revenue recognition guidance and the conceptual framework discussion paper, to really kind of define economic benefits as the potential cash flows that can be derived either directly or indirectly from using the asset. So we probably should have used more consistent wording in example 4A. We weren't trying to imply that there was kind of a difference from one sentence to the other, but we would be proposing to clarify the guidance by defining economic benefits as the potential cash flows.
Just a clarification. Did people have trouble with the term economic benefits in the exposure draft, or have we just decided to change it?
So there were a couple of reasons that we're proposing this clarification. One is, as I said, just general consistency with what's, you know, in revenue recognition and the conceptual framework DP. Another is that we thought it would just kind of provide a more tangible basis on which to make the assessment. It wasn't that constituents were criticizing the economic benefits language. It was more, you know, they just generally requested more guidance, more tangible ways of making the assessment. So we thought that would be one avenue of providing that. But it is just meant to be a clarification, not any sort of major change.
I just worry that it might confuse things sometimes.
Doc?
Thank you. Same thing with that part. About example 4 and example 4A, to me, it was difficult to understand what these examples try to explain. So in the example, you mentioned two things. In the example 4 case, this is highly specialized operation. And on the other one is the location is fixed. So which of the two you want to emphasize? So if you say the operation itself is highly specialized, there are many other services who has lots of highly specialized services. And as far as location is concerned, I think location makes a big difference on the cash flow. But for the example of the rig, maybe stop operation or keep operation, such kind of decision making is more important than simply just operation, the technical difficulty. So therefore, it was quite difficult to understand these example 4 and 4A. And the other things I just want to mention on this example 4 and 4A and example 1 and 2 is if you use such a special example like oil rig or chartered ship, it could be interpreted you are going to penalize one industry and entertain one industry. So even though you are trying to explain the principle, but people would interpret it as far as chartered is concerned, it's a lease. As far as oil rig is concerned, it's not lease. So it could be interpreted in this way. So there is a danger. So if you want to explain the principle, you could use the example like a taxi hire, rent a car, or something like that. That would be much better and straightforward to understand. And one more thing I just want to mention is that the change you made is you are going to emphasize the cash flow compared to the ED. I think it's good, straightforward, it's easy to understand. But if you say cash flow, it's the same point with the part, then this lease on the chairs or, you know, offices do not directly, you know, generate cash flow. So there would be a misunderstanding. So that's the point I want to raise.
So just on your points on examples 4 and 4A, we weren't trying to emphasize one kind of factor over the other in terms of location or specialization. What we were attempting to do with those examples is really illustrate the clarification we're proposing, that we were proposing in most cases the how and for what purpose decision is going to be the decision that most affects the economic benefits, that most affects the cash flows. But there will be some limited cases where that might not be the decision that most significantly affects the cash flows. Operations decisions might be those decisions that most significantly affect the cash flows. And we do have in paragraph 51 of the paper a number of indicators where if those indicators are present, then they would indicate that operations are important. But we're not meaning to say that any one of the indicators is more important than the other. Probably you would need kind of all three to conclude that operations would be the most important. But so it wasn't to say that one would be more important than the other. You should really be looking at it more holistically. And this will be an area that you will need to use judgment, and that's what we were trying to illustrate in the examples, but I appreciate if it didn't come across so clearly. And just on your point on, you know, kind of penalizing certain industries or focusing on certain industries, part of the thinking behind including these specific examples was, you know, a lot of the questions that we had gotten on the ED really did focus on these areas like the shipping contracts or the drilling contracts, where it is much more of a gray area where the customer and the supplier do share a lot of decision making and it isn't as straightforward of an assessment. So we thought that it would be potentially helpful to you know, really include examples kind of dealing with the more gray areas, but I take your point that, you know, maybe in the final standard that wouldn't be the best way forward. It was more kind of for the purposes of this paper to really illustrate the gray areas.
Yeah. On 3A, a different example, so shifting gears slightly in this example, to, you know, one thing I struggled with a bit and would appreciate some insight on is the balancing between terms that are specified in the contract, decisions that are kind of pre-made and specified in the contract versus decisions that are left, because as the pool of decisions that are left shrinks, they grow in significance when taken in the context of an item as a whole. They might be relatively insignificant one. And I was looking, I think it's example 2, the ship charter. And thinking less about, you know, a single voyage one, then let's say instead that example was for, I've been looking at the wrong paper, was for two, you know, for the transport services for 2 years from point, you know, from point A to point B, I think it's London to Sydney, and on an, you know, identified ship, and whether it's on an identified ship or requires a, you know, specialized kind of ship, that means there are a relatively few that can do it, so you are in effect specifying a ship. If the terms of the transport contract specify with reasonably tightly the pickup and the delivery date, you know, so that it leaves relatively little, if any, flexibility for the supplier, I don't see then why the decision, you know, the relatively small pool of decisions that's left in terms of exactly which course or, you know, what the shifts are assigned on the ship become the significant operating decisions. Now, I haven't heard other people raising this so far, so it just may be me coming a bit late to the leases discussion, but I was concerned that we were just, you know, not fundamentally wrong, but slightly off balance in terms of the weighting given to the decisions that are pre-made in the contract versus the decisions that are left when assessing who has control over the operating decisions. If there's anything you could kind of do to color that in a bit more for me, that would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of area of the clarifications that we're proposing really has to do with the proposal in the 2013 ED that kind of specifying the output of an asset in itself wouldn't give you the ability to control the use of an asset. And this kind of goes to the concept of control that is in IFRS 10 that really says that you need to have the current ability to control an asset, that you need to be able to currently make decisions that you know influence the economic benefits that you could get from an asset. And I guess kind of, you know, some of the rationale behind that is if all you can do is specify the output of an asset, you don't actually have any more decision-making rights than any other customer that's just coming along and taking up, you know, 1/10 of the capacity of that asset or 1/100th or, you know, a half of the asset. That you really need to be able to make decisions throughout the term of the contract that will affect the economic benefits of the asset in order to control the asset. And so what we're proposing in the paper is nothing more than kind of clarifying that idea that was in the 2013 ED. It was just that the words in the 2013 ED were slightly confusing because they were kind of implying that if you were involved in setting up the contract, then that should be considered, but also that output in itself wouldn't give you control. So these clarifications are really just more meant to be consistent with that output kind
of. Yeah, and that's where I was struggling because it isn't, I mean, I went back and looked, albeit quickly, at, you know, at IFRS 10 and the parallel bits and that standard. And that seemed to be saying, when do you look back to involvement in the formation documents and start to look at the attribution of risks and rewards, essentially? And it specifies limited circumstances when there are really only administrative tasks that are the remaining operating decisions. But when I try to translate this to, you know, this example, I say, if I entered into a contract that essentially ties up a specific asset, and it's the terms of the supply contract that do that, that seems to be the operating decisions that are relevant to the cash flows of the asset for the period of the contract. And I think I would be happier if I was starting to explore the issues that we were just discussing about. Could I substitute another ship? Could I deliver the goods via another direction? And your point about taking 1/10 or 1/100th of the capacity versus all of it, I would imagine if I were signing a contract that was only for 1/100th or even 1/10th, I wouldn't get to specify such specific dates, or, you know, it's looking at the contract and saying, am I basically directing how this ship will be used for, in my variant, 2 years? You know, what route will it be? How much time does it allow from downtime? And maybe it's only one direction, in which case the company has void to use the return journey in other times. Well, then maybe that feels less like a lease. But if the terms are such that the fact that there are relatively few decisions and they're left to the operator during the journey doesn't matter that personally, it doesn't matter that much to me if the terms of my supply contract predetermine those. And so I'm just going back to that balance, and are we giving enough weight to the service contract? Or to the contract that may be a service contract?
If I understand what you're saying, Mary, I mean, are you saying, though, I think, and if I understand you rightly, is by virtue of the fact that you are taking all of the benefits from this thing, that you've effectively locked up all of the output on this asset, that is enough to say it's control for you?
It's not automatically that I've got the output, but rather I have to consider what operating decisions are hardwired by virtue of the contract that may be a service or not.
But then aren't you saying then that for every single contract then, if we do that, that you'll be asking people to do an assessment that weights up how much decision making has gone into coming up with the contractual terms versus over and doing a weighting, and that just seems to be...
Not necessarily a weighting, but considering it, you know, literally considering it in terms of, perhaps it's more in terms of the question of, is there an identified asset? Or not, because when I looked at this, it just seemed that the narrow focus on the operating decisions about how do I get from A to B seemed relatively trivial in light of the decision to commit this ship for a trip on the following schedule from point A to point B. And it isn't that committing the ship to a journey from point A to point B automatically says, I've leased that asset, but it's how much how specific is that commitment?
So you would say, if I understand you correctly, you'd say that if I said get it from point A to point B and I specified the exact dates, I'd say it's a lease, but if I said there's a bit of flexibility in whether you pick it up today or tomorrow at both ends, and you deliver it today and tomorrow, then you might say it's not a lease?
Yeah, because it brings in question of, are there other ships I could use? Are there other services that I can provide with that asset in that time, and I'm making more of the decision. And if it's a 4-hour window if a voyage has weather, etc., plus or minus 48 hours, as the tightness, and I give somebody 60 hours, okay, that doesn't change it a bit. But if it's a plus or minus 2 weeks either end, it feels more like a service. They're more decisions to be made, but it gets back to how much do the terms that are agreed in the contract have to be considered in this decision, in this evaluation of benefits. And this example is sending a message to me that if it's in the terms of the contract, it's excluded from the identification.
And that is our intention, mm-hmm. with this, in carrying forward the principle that was in the 2013 ED, and also carrying forward how we assess control and IFRS 10.
And that to me sends a message that if you want it to be a service, predetermine all the major operating decisions and put them into the contract.
And that is right, by the way, and that is what this is saying, but just to understand that the only way you would get that to end up being a service in your example is you would have to lock in all of that for the entire 2 years up front, and you would have to have no ability to change that. So if suddenly something goes wrong, that, and you getting your goods to the port in Sydney, you end up being a day late, you can't change that. So the only way, but that's the answer. If you predetermine everything and you have no ability to change that, we'd say that would mean it's a service, just exactly in IFRS 10. If we said you predetermined all of what happens inside this particular structured entity in advance and you had no ability to step in and change that, you'd end up saying you didn't control the structured entity.
Then
so it's kind
you,
of
you achieved your objective then for me in terms of clarifying that that's what you're saying. I guess I'm just a little wobbly about whether we should be saying that.
Thanks. I guess I have to return to example 4 and 4A, because hearing Mary's, hearing Taka, and your words right now explaining about the no ability, I'm really confused with example 4 and 4A, because they are based, the difference is the expectation. The only difference I see here, the expectation to change the location of the rig many times during the contract. So I think we need more clarity here in these two examples, because the way I see at inception is both of them are leasing. Because you use the words, your words, the ability to cite from the day one to the end of the contract, the very same equipment, doing the very performing the very same type of services, could be drilling in this case. So those characterize for me, to me, leasing arrangements. And then we come in example 4A, say, well, but the customer expect to change multiple times, so this is a lease. When it doesn't expect to change
only if there is an unforeseen problem, it this is service. I think it's quite weak in my view to differentiate and ascertain that the example four is a service and not a lease.
I mean, just so you know, don't get me wrong, I think your comments are saying clearly in developing our examples as we do in you know, quite short format and papers, we haven't put enough in there to explain the differentiation, but just if it's helpful, our idea with 4 and 4A is not to have these pretend to be exactly the same contracts with exactly the same rigs, with the only difference being the expectation. We didn't do it well enough, but our idea was that these are actually, they happen to be drilling rigs, but they're completely different. One is being used for exploitation purposes, one is being used for exploring purposes. They probably function in, they do, I mean, our intention was they function in completely different ways, because the one that's doing exploring is intentionally much less costly to move around, because you plan to move it around, because you're just, you know, exploring to work out where oil is, and it's, there's every intention and expectation that you will constantly be, you know, moving it around to try, you know, to explore a particular field, to work out where there, you know, where oil is, versus, you know, something that you already know, you've done the exploring and you already know exactly where the oil is, and you intend to just, you know, use it to exploit and extract oil. So I understand why you raised concerns, and I think we didn't draw out the difference, but our intention was that these were, you know, two completely different things, with not only the expectation of location being the difference, but very much the, you know, the operations of each of the rigs being quite different as well.
Sue?
Firstly, I think we need to be careful not to give the impression to the outside world that tiny nuanced differences are going to create such big differences, because we're focusing on such finite points. I think usually it should be hopefully blindingly obvious whether you have a lease or a service, and also one would hope it's sort of a more holistic analysis, and by stepping through these individual points we're making it look like it's a very granular thing, which comes down to that in some cases, but not all the time. But there was one observation in the paper that sort of was almost made in passing, but I wonder whether it would be helpful sometimes in the cases where we do have some of the points like Mary was focusing on in terms of how specific is the lease and also how much predetermination is there, which is unlike IFRS 10 where we have entities where we do acknowledge the fact that it may be the case that nobody controls an SPE. In this paper you make the observation, I think, that there will always be somebody controlling the right of use. So it's either going to be the supplier or it's going to be the potential lessee. So I think sometimes in these grey cases, and particularly if it's coming down to very sort of administrative decisions that are left over, rather than saying I've got the only decisions that are left over, therefore do I have a lease? Do I have control of the right of use? If you flipped it around the other way and said, well, look at all of the other stuff that's left over for the supplier, it may be more obvious by looking at the supplier side of things what the outcome is than trying to labour the lessee's analysis so much. And so maybe making it more clear that there's sort of two sides that you could think of to help you make the decision if that's what's intended might be helpful in some cases.
No, because I think, by the way, your point is exactly right, too, and maybe that would be actually helpful in the assessment, that I think in the context of a lease, when you're talking about controlling the use of an asset, we would think that you're always having to conclude that either the customer or the supplier controls the use during the period of the contract. You know, it always has to be one or the other. So as you say, it's always about a waiting, therefore, of working out, well, which one is really, you know, making the most important decisions and controlling it all. So it's absolutely. I've worked out we're down to 11 minutes to go with two papers to discuss.
Go on.
Yeah, we continue. If we move on to paper 3B, separating lease and non-lease components, this of course follows the first paper. So it says when you've decided that a contract contains a lease, what should you do if the contract also contains other things? The paper split into two sections. The first is asking whether we think we need requirements or guidance about separating lease components. So that's basically saying should I consider that this contract has one lease, or do I consider that it has, you know, three leases, one lease of three assets or three separate leases? And then the second part of the paper goes on to talk about separating lease and non-lease components. There we're suggesting a change from the 2013 ED for lessees, where we would suggest that when separating and allocating overall consideration to lease and non-lease, a lessee should use the best information available to it, but in the absence of observable information, that lessee would be allowed to use estimates in coming up with the allocation. And the paper also talks about whether you would want to include, as a practical expedient, sort of to permit lessees not to have to separate lease and non-lease. Questions?
Can I? Yes, it's about the reallocation of consideration between the lease and the services component in the case where there is a reassessment of the lease term. Let's assume I rent a building with some services attached to it for 3 years, and I have an option to extend for one further year. And if I reassess at some point my lease term as being 4 years rather than 3 years, why should I necessarily reallocate the components? The prices would just continue for one more year with the same split between lease and services component. So as a minimum, maybe you could say, should consider whether the change in the lease term necessitates a reallocation. But I don't think that in many cases there will be a need to reallocate, unless the pricing of the services component will significantly affect the pricing of the lease component depending on the length of the service, which I think is quite a rare situation. But in most cases, things will continue as before. So I think we're a bit too strict in saying you must reallocate. I think you only consider whether the length of the lease will change the allocation.
I think there, by the way, Philippe, just to explain, I don't know whether the reallocate is maybe the wrong word to use, as you say, that perhaps it is if you only considered this initially to be, say, a three-year lease in your case because, you know, you assumed you weren't going to exercise any options and then you change your assessment. I think that because you were only accounting for 3 years of the lease, it might have been that you only, you know, looked at the consideration for those 3 years and allocated it, and it's just if you extend the period, almost what we're saying is you just do an allocation for the new extended period. But I think you're right that maybe it's just terminology.
Well, I mean, there might be a need to reallocate in the case that during the extended period, mm-hmm. don't have the same components as before. Mm-hmm. And then the overall lease term might be reallocated on a different basis. But if the extended period continues unchanged compared to the preceding period, there is no need to reallocate anything. That's my point.
Scott, did I explain that okay, or do you want to come in on it?
I guess I would just explain that maybe on a practical basis, if you've gone from 3 years to 4 years, there may not be any need to reallocate. However, we've already decided that when you reassess, you're going to remeasure your lease liability, including establishing a new discount rate and establishing a new pool of consideration. So let's take a more common example that might actually trigger a reassessment. You go from a 5-year building lease to a, 3 years in, you build significant leasehold improvements, and it now becomes 7 years remaining instead of two. You're going to remeasure a completely new pool of consideration, and at that point where you're now deciding I have a 7-year lease, I think you have to at that point take a fresh cut at how much am I allocating between the lease component and, let's say, a maintenance component for that remaining 7 years. I guess I don't think we assumed it would be simpler to somehow keep the remaining 2-year allocation and then try and layer on some different allocation related to the 5 years you just added to the lease liability, since we decided, if it's not a separate new lease, this modification, you're really left with just a 7-year lease. And the simplest way that we thought of and the most appropriate way to allocate is to say we now have a 7-year lease of this building. There's a lease and a non-lease component. let's take a fresh cut at this and reallocate the consideration to the lease and non-lease component.
Mary? Question about a different issue, which is the recommendation of the staff to provide guidance on identifying the separate lease components. So it's the TF to question one. And it struck me, and I wondered if you guys, as the staff, worked through this, that at least from an ISB perspective, if we're saying, on the whole, let's not change lessor accounting. You know, you've noted, I think it's in paragraph 15, that there haven't been any significant practice issues that we're aware of in this area. But if we introduce specific guidance, I think it does create, especially for retrospective application, a pretty significant burden in terms of going back and looking at existing leases under that guidance. And if I have concerns about doing it for lessors, I would not want to issue guidance on that applied only to lessees. I think it's an all or nothing. So I, you know, agree with your approach that says if we're going to do it, let's do it for everybody. But the potential cost, without, you know, from the arguments in 15, what I see is significant benefits. We can always improve things a little, but sometimes I think by a desire to just polish, we, you know, can bring costs that outweigh the benefits. And I wondered if you had that cost benefit kind of consideration when making the developing the recommendation.
I mean, I think, Mary, in this area, and you're right to highlight, there's some kind of different views, I suppose, in paragraphs 15 and 16. I think the need, I mean, the separating lease components guidance is something that doesn't exist in either existing IFRS or US GAAP, but we did include in the 2013 ED. However, the main reason it was included in the 2013 ED was to address questions that could arise because of the classification guidance then that said you actually had different classification guidance for property and non-property. Yes. So in my view, I think that, you know, the arguments to say we need this have reduced now in light of the changes the boards have made to lessee and lessor accounting models. In saying that, I think, you know, others do have the view that they think this would still overall be beneficial, and it is a missing piece of guidance from sort of existing requirements, and they think it would be helpful. But I think there are arguments.
I'd like to support Mary, and not just retrospectively, but we've made the decision the lessor model's not broken, and that we don't want to change it. And every time we fiddle with anything, we just kind of force them to go back and reassess for no particular benefit.
With 2 minutes to go, I'm just checking if there are any other questions on paper 3B. Do you want to quickly do paper 3C?
Yeah, so very shortly, agenda paper 3C discusses initial direct cost and more specifically which cost should be considered initial direct cost. It also touches on the accounting for initial direct costs. In the paper we have two approaches. Approach one is a narrow definition of initial direct cost, which is similar to that used in revenue recognition. And approach two would retain essentially the definition of initial direct cost under IS 17. And with 1.5 minutes left, I hand over to you.
Question?
Yep.
May I?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Considering Ian's comment just 1 minute before on lessor side, so if we decide at the end of the day we are not changing any lessor, so at the end of the day we have only one alternative here, right? If we seek for consistency between lessee and lessor on the definition direct side. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That, yeah.
Although I think it depends on forgetting the fact that we have a leasing project, which is a major thing to forget. You know, given that we both are about to issue a revenue standard, what changes would we want to consider to other standards as a result of revenue standard?
Except that you make the point that you always knew that the treatment of acquisition costs would be different, you know, because we've discussed the three projects side by side. So we went into the last ED knowing very clearly that we were capturing different pools of acquisition costs in the three contracts. It was a, you know, something the boards considered, thought about, and decided to do.
I mean, just to, only as a reminder, last point is, of course, I agree that or the decisions in March on the lessor model for our board, for the ISB, essentially means no change to you know, to IS 17 for lessors in our context. Of course, the decisions of the FASB means that it's not a big shift, but there is some change in lessor accounting for the FASB. So I think sometimes, you know, when we have joint discussions, we just need to be aware that whilst we're essentially not changing lessor, the FASB is, you know, there is a slight change for the FASB in their lessor model. So sometimes the boards are in slightly different places on that.
Okay, with 10 seconds left.
We look forward to Thursday.